They were children when the Celtic Tiger crashed. They were teenagers when the IMF bailout arrived. And they've now become adults in an Ireland that in many ways still hasn't recovered. And by they, I might mean myself. The bailout babies, the generation born into the boom and shaped by the bust, are suddenly everywhere. In the polling booths, on the emigration flights, in box rooms across the country, and at the heart of the culture of 2025, from CMAT to NECAP. And it feels like this year they've found their voice. It's News Talk Daily. I'm Sean Defoe. Today we are asking, who are Ireland's bailout babies? How have they reshaped adulthood, politics, dating, work and housing? And why does 2025 feel like the moment that this generation, cynical, creative, angry, yet hopeful maybe, finally stepped into the spotlight? With me is the journalist who has been documenting their lives, Adam Maguire, author of The Bailout Babies. You are very welcome to News Talk Daily.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So are we both bailout babies? Are we, like, what's the definition of the age range?
I'm 40. I aged myself out of the definition of bailout babies. So my definition of what I call a bailout baby is someone who was born during the Celtic Tiger, but wasn't an adult when the crash hit, basically. So you can kind of go from 92 up to 2007, which was kind of the last year of the Celtic Tiger. 2008 was when the downturn started. So basically 18 to kind of early to mid 30s, maybe. You can kind of stretch that maybe a little bit, but I feel like I got in just ahead of this. So I don't kind of consider myself a bailout baby. People a little bit younger than me would be, though, I'd say.
Right. Okay. Where were you when the bailout happened?
Well, I was a freelance journalist at the time. My now wife and I had started renting a little flat, fairly, we were only talking about it recently, half a house basically in Finglas. It was split in two. But it was grand. We could afford it. I was a freelance journalist only starting out. She was an SNA. So we weren't earning big money, but we could afford to get our own place and we could afford to kind of have a bit of a life. You know, we'd go out, you know, to the pub and we'd get takeaways and all that kind of stuff. And we could afford to save as well. We spent a couple of years then saving for our own place. So yeah, I was probably lucky in one way. I didn't buy during the Celtic Tiger years and get saddled with a lot of negative equity. I also was able, we were able then to buy just as things started to pick up in terms of the you know, prices starting to rise again. It would have been, what would that have been, 2015 or so, I think we bought. So things were kind of still modest at that stage. So yeah, I think I got lucky. I escaped the kind of worst of it.
Yeah, hit that kind of sweet spot.
Yeah, just about. Yeah. We said another year or two and it probably would have started to get out of reach for us even. But yeah, we were lucky, yeah.
Yeah, it's funny because I just find even with, you know, the bailout babies or whatever generation we're all, I think everybody at the moment still shapes themselves a little bit by where they were in life when the crash hit.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, it had such, and I think this is kind of the remarkable thing, like, that we probably haven't spoken about it much as a country, but it had, like, such a profound effect on everybody. Obviously, I was focusing on people who are only children when things kind of went belly up. But, you know, families were reshaped by this, families torn apart, homes having to be sold, there was mass immigration, divorce, suicide. You know, it really did reshape, you know, households and the country. And I think it led to us being, we've become more risk averse as a country as well. We've kind of, there's kind of scars there in terms of, you know, when we currently have, you know, quite a good economy and things are quite well. I think everybody still has that little voice in the back of their head going, yeah, but things are going to go bad at some stage because that happened before. Things were great and then suddenly. So I think it's definitely left its scars on all of us, not just young people who now are kind of picking up the pieces of it.
Mm. Why do you think it's kind of only really around now through the likes of your book, but also, you know, the kind of music and cultural scene, if you look at CMAT talking about Bertie Ahern this year, that it's taken a while for it to filter through, even though what I would consider my generation are kind of into their 30s who are old enough to, like, I remember when the crash hit just through watching the news and absolutely hating anything to do with Fianna Fáil. You know, that was my absorption of it, that they had ruined my future.
Yeah, I think it is interesting. Maybe it's the fact that the last of the Tiger Cubs, as you might call them, the people born in the Celtic Tiger years, are now 18 this year. So if you were born in 2007, you're 18 this year. Maybe, like, that's it, that they're now kind of reaching a critical mass. You know, at the other end of it, people who by now would have grown up in the Celtic Tiger, seeing all of this money, seeing their maybe older siblings doing quite well and buying houses and all that stuff, kind of going, well, it hasn't happened for me. I was promised all of this and that frustration has grown as well. Maybe we just need a little bit of distance from the event. And I think there's also a frustration of feeling, and is going to see Matt really vocalise that frustration that this massive thing happened in the country. It affected all of us, particularly young people. And it doesn't feel like anything really happened as a consequence of that. There was really no one really held accountable for it. The parties that were in government at the time are still in government now. The banks that, you know, were part of the Celtic Tiger and the crash are still the banks that we have to deal with today as well. And there's a feeling like, were any lessons really learned from this? Or is it just that, you know, we all have to pick up the pieces and just move on with it?
I think there is an element as well, and I may feel a little bit of bitterness about this as well, that there was a generation that got to party.
Yeah.
And they fair enough, they had the consequences, but Jesus, they had a good time doing it. Whereas now we have a booming economy. And I was talking to someone in this studio, actually, who's, and I was saying, I wonder, will there be a recession in the next few years? And they said, please, God, can we at least have a bit of fun before there's another recession again?
I think that is definitely a part of it, that if you were old enough in the Celtic Tiger years and maybe a kid, you were looking at this and going, this is great. Look at all these people. The minute I'm out of college or I'm out of school or whatever it is, it's going to be great. I'm going to get my own place. I'm going to have a great job. I'm going to have a great lifestyle. And obviously that rug was pulled before eternity. But yeah, like, I think there is a feeling that even though now the economy is doing well and technically even better than it was during the Celtic Tiger years, it's not being felt in the same way. Now, to some degree, that the cracks were being papered over in the Celtic Tiger years because the banks were throwing money at everybody, which is kind of part of the problem. Whereas now they're much more conservative than they would have been, and rightly so. But yeah, I think there is that frustration of, you know, things are going really well again, but I don't feel the benefit of it. You know, I'm not able to enjoy myself. I'm not able to progress in life in the way that I'd like to. You know, there's a lot more job insecurity now than there was, you know, 10, 20 years ago in terms of the gig economy and, you know, multinational employers much more willing to just say, we need to boost our profits, so we're just going to let you go. So I think there is that kind of frustration of we missed the boat and now we're having to pick up the pieces because of that. We're the ones paying the price for it, really.
Mm. You spoke to obviously a lot of people who were in this sort of bailout babies age group while you were doing the book. And I the list of topics, I suppose, that are most frustrating is probably fairly exhaustive. I would imagine housing, immigration. Was there one that maybe cropped up that surprised you that a lot of people were saying, or that you weren't expecting going into writing the book?
I was kind of surprised by the immigration side of it because when I was kind of thinking through, okay, what areas do I need to look at and you know, plan out, I was saying, right, well, I need, immigration is a factor, so I need to maybe talk to someone who's just emigrated or is just about to emigrate. How will I do that? And so on. So when I started then going, talking to people about other things, it just came up that, oh, well, I'm going to be emigrating in a couple of months, or my friends are all in Australia. I'm probably going to follow them once, you know, my girlfriend finishes college or once I finish, you know, this job or whatever it is. That kind of surprised me just how prevalent it was. And when I looked at the figures then, I realized we talk about immigration to the country at the moment and, you know, with this sharp rise in recent years, when you kind of pull out the Irish figures, so the Irish citizens, we actually have net emigration now for the last 3 years or so. Relatively low. I think you're talking about 11,000 people over the past 3 years. So relatively low. But that's kind of remarkable when there's a massive boom going on in the economy. We're used to emigration, but it usually coincides with the recession and when the economy isn't doing well. So the fact that thousands of Irish people who, despite the fact that things are on paper going very well here, they're saying, I have better opportunities elsewhere, that was kind of surprising to me. I was also a little bit surprised by, there wasn't a huge amount of anger. There was definitely frustration. There was kind of a resignation of, well, I'm just never going to get a house. That was kind of part of the attitude. And frustration that, you know, older generations kind of have this attitude of, well, you're just not trying hard enough, you know.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, I wouldn't say it was anger, which was kind of surprising. And people were just kind of getting on with it, which was remarkable and good to see. But also you felt a bit, God, like, is that just what you have to do? You just have to kind of be resilient and just get on with it.
Yeah, it's if, and I've thought about this before, even among my friends group, and there's a lot of them who wouldn't be anywhere near getting a house. Mm. But like you say, there isn't protest on the street. There's a couple you see every year. And, you know, I'm not to dismiss any of those. But in terms of like this mass generational protest, that anger that usually drives those, just, I wonder why it isn't there.
Yeah, I'm kind of perplexed by that to some degree as well. I mean, we saw in, not the election last year, but the one before, there was this groundswell and it seemed like something was happening and there was this massive support going behind Sinn Féin. And obviously, you know, they became the biggest party, but they didn't get into government. And then the election last year, there wasn't that feeling around that. There didn't feel like there was this mass movement towards, an alternative, so to speak, whatever that may have been. We did maybe see it a little bit in the presidential election. Mm. And we saw, younger voters really kind of coalescing around Catherine Connolly. I suppose part of that might have been because she was the de facto opposition candidate and all of the kind of left-leaning parties kind of gathered around her. So that maybe made it easier as the obvious choice. They also turned out to vote, which they often don't do. Which is kind of part of the problem as well. But yeah, it is interesting. I wonder again, is it like that release valve that's been there before, that emigration, people who are that frustrated tend to just emigrate rather than stay here and fight and make a big deal about it that you might see in other countries.
Yeah, maybe the angry voices are all in Australia and yeah, not being able to lead it. When you were, I suppose, looking at those emigration figures, there is a sense, and I know some of my own mates or peers, they're gone over 2 years, but they're not really gone because they couldn't get on here. They're gone for a bit of a jolly They're going to have a good time. But I think you were writing that the majority isn't actually that case.
Yeah, like I there absolutely is that kind of cohort of people who are just saying, oh, look, I may as well, I'll go and enjoy myself and I'll come back and maybe I'll earn big money, especially, you hear of kind of jobs going in the Middle East where, there's no tax and they get paid really well. So I'm going to save up a deposit while I'm over and then come back. I do wonder about that. A lot of the people I spoke to, some of them were saying, oh, we'll see in 2 years. I spoke to one person who went, having gotten frustrated here with that kind of, we'll see how it goes. And now is pretty much there for life now. And I think that's the unknown thing that you'll go over there and in 2 years time, maybe you found a partner and you've kind of started to put down roots. Or maybe you look and say, okay, I'm not settled here, but things don't look any better back in Ireland. So there's no, it's not like suddenly now I'll go back and things will be easier for me. So what's the reason to come back? And I wonder, there is that risk, even people who are leaving now with a plan of coming back in 2 years, in reality, will they do that? Or will they just look and say, it's no better, I may as well stay where I am?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. And I was thinking of you, I was reading this article a couple of weeks ago after your book came out in The Guardian. And it said that millennials are set to become the wealthiest generation in history. And I thought, here we go, more millennial bashing. But the subtext of the article was, millennials will become the wealthiest generation in history when they inherit the wealth of their dead parents, which led me to your chapter, Waiting for Death, that you very cheerily titled in your book.
Well, it did occur to me. So yeah, you have this problem. I mean, obviously, it's very, very hard to get a mortgage as a first-time buyer, even if you have two incomes and, two decent incomes. But there is this time bomb, essentially, with mortgages, that as you get older, the banks are only going to loan you money up until you retire. So the window starts to shrink. When you get into your 30s, suddenly the window starts to shrink. And it'll get to a point where even if your income is going up, your repayments have risen by so much that you can't square that circle. And so you are basically then relying on either your parents to give you a lump sum, which more and more people are getting their parents to give them a chunk of money to go towards a house, or you're waiting on your parents to shuffle off and you can inherit the house and take your share of it or take the entire house, which is a really grim thought. Yes. For most people it's a grim thought. Some people might relish that prospect, but like for most people it's like, God, would you even want to be kind of countenance that thought? Hopefully, in a couple of years' time now, they'll be gone. And And is that now kind of the policy that, well, it'll be fine because their parents have to die eventually, so they'll just get that house, which, I don't think that's a good formation for a housing policy or for demographics or for anything else.
No, especially if that you're then waiting into your 50s for them to get into their 80s or whatever.
And this is part of the equation and so on. It's a good thing that people are living longer and living healthier. They're staying in their homes for longer, which is all great. But it means then that, whereas in the past, those people might have inherited the family home at an earlier stage in their lives, they're now going to be a lot older before that happens, which is a good thing, but it has a negative consequence for those people. And it means they can't rely on that as something that, in my 30s, I'll probably inherit the house. It'll probably be into their 50s before that happens.
And then there is the distorting effect on the rest of the market that people who do have the bank of mum and dad getting gifted whatever amount it is has on other people who are trying to buy who don't have that luxury.
Yeah, absolutely, because it just pushes up the price essentially. And, I think there's been certain different stats to say half of first-time buyers are getting help from their parents. Now, that mightn't be unusual. Even people who mightn't have parents who are particularly well off might have gotten a bit of money from their parents to go towards the deposit. But there was figures from Dodl saying, some are getting tens, even hundreds of thousands from their parents, which fair play to them and all that, but there's a, you know, the vast majority of people don't have that luxury of their parents being able to kind of hand them over that kind of money. And it means that it just pushes up the price. If you're competing with someone who has 50 grand in their back pocket from the get-go, you know, then you're immediately at a massive disadvantage. It also puts the parents under pressure as well. That might have been money that they had kind of earmarked for their own retirement, something they want to do it. And others who maybe don't have the cash on hand are turning to the likes of lifetime loans, where they're basically remortgaging a part of their house to hand that over to their, give the inheritance early, basically. But that comes at a cost, because the interest rate on that is kind of sizable. It builds up over time, and it can become expensive. There's stats to say, you know, this generation are so wealthy. That's based on the fact that their property is worth a lot of money. They might not have any cash in the bank, but they happen to be in a house that's worth 600 grand. But they're living day to day in terms of their income. That's where their wealth is. So they might feel the pressure to kind of unlock that in some way and give it to their children to get them on the ladder.
Yeah, there's a really good anecdote actually in the book about that, and a family who did that sort of lifetime loan that you're talking about.
Yeah.
What did you find when talking to people about the intergenerational stresses? And I don't mean what we were talking about earlier in terms of, oh, I'm really bitter towards someone in their 50s because they had a great time and they're now sitting on their million euro house and they're grand. But the people who are living in the box room, and if I think the median age now, is it a buying house 40 or something in around
it's,
that?
It's fast approaching that now, according to the last census. Yeah,
so like
38, I think. Well, that was 3 years ago, so it's probably gone up a little bit since then. So
very few people, when they have lovely little baby boy or girl, are thinking, you'll be here when you're 40 and I'll be happy for you.
The book is very much focused on the bailout babies, but you know, you have to kind of give acknowledgement to the fact that this isn't ideal for anybody. You know, there might have been people who thought, in a couple of years' time now, I'll have that room, I can turn it into an office, I can turn it into a spare room, I can turn it into whatever kind of private thing you might want to get up to in the comfort of your own home. But they can't do that. And they're suddenly now, you know, someone was saying to me, you know, a psychologist I spoke to, you're meant to leave the family home and then you visit once in a while and you have a nice relationship, you catch up with each other. And then when you've had enough of each other, you go your separate ways and you'll see you in a week, and that's great. But you're seeing each other day in and day out. You're still treating your child like a child. They feel they're an adult. They want to be treated like one. And in some cases, they might have really important jobs, a lot of responsibility. And then they walk through the door, come home, and suddenly they're a kid again and they're being given out to for not, you know, cleaning up after themselves, or you made a mess in the kitchen or whatever it might be. It's just, it's frustrating for everybody. And I make the comparison with The Simpsons. You know, I say, look, there's a generation Bart, because they're eternal children, basically. You know, they're not being given the opportunity to grow up. They're not being given the opportunity to learn how to behave. You go and do a house share with a couple of friends and they give out to you for cleaning up. You listen to them more than you would your parents, and you learn the lesson, oh yeah, that's actually not on to be making a mess for someone else to pick up. Your parents say that to you, you kind of roll your eyes and go, yeah, whatever. So I think, you know, it's all of these things. And obviously then a very simple thing like dating is a big problem for these few people. You know, if you're living in your parents' box room, it makes it a lot harder to date. And you can kind of get away with that in your teens and maybe even early 20s. You know, it's not a big deal. When you're getting into your 30s and you're still trying to bring your date back to your parents' house, like that's very
sneak them in and have no one know.
The guy I talked to at a dating night who was telling me how he had learned how to kind of coordinate footsteps with his date going up the stairs, so his parents only heard one set of footsteps coming in. And he was saying like his parents were sound about it and all that, but he just felt the need to kind of mask it a bit, you know?
Yeah.
And like, you know, you're a young couple, kind of an early stage of your relationship. There's things you want to be doing when you want to do them. And the idea that you have to be, well, my parents are home now, so we can't do that. And, you know, or we'll have to be really quiet. And
Getting soundproofing on the
Exactly.
Room.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Ideal.
And I should say as well, not to be ageist, vice versa for the parents as well, because they'll want to be doing things that they don't want their kids to be hearing. So, you know, it's frustrating for everybody.
What did you make of the Department of Housing sharing that spun out video on how to live in a box room?
It was one of those things where, I can see the discussion and the well-intentioned kind of thing here, but it was tone deaf in a way, because it's just, you know, it does feel a little bit of kind of an admission. It is a reality, though. There are people, and I kind of feel the most maybe for those, you know, the people who are coming back, because you know, you have that thing of you get your bit of freedom and you know what it's like and you have your own routine and all that. And then suddenly you have to come back to your parents and like that sink back into their routine and sink back into being a kid in their home. I had a tiny taste of it myself because I went abroad to study for the guts of a year. and then came back home and went back to my parents. And you suddenly realize, oh God, like I actually really enjoyed having my own place. And
yeah,
you know, then the focus was let's get out of here as quickly as possible. But they just don't have that choice. So I do understand that the motivation for the video, maybe it was helpful to some, but it does feel like a bit of a, oh God, you know, is that really the message you want to be sending out?
Yeah, I can totally see why Spun Out made the video. Like that's totally fair. But then, like you say, to have the government department that is nominally in charge of fixing that problem, sharing it.
Yeah, and I think if Spun Out had done it on their own, it probably wouldn't have been really, you know, a big deal. It would have been, yeah, okay, fair enough, this is helpful. But the fact that it was then pushed out by the Department of Housing kind of gave it a different kind of, you know, tinge to it, really. Yeah.
To give, I suppose, a wider societal look at all of this, milestones are getting later. We've talked about buying a house later in life, but, you know, getting to live with a person. And quite often for our generation, you really got to know your partner by living with them. And that was the test for marriage and kids and all that. Yeah. Now it's all squished into such a small space of time. I do wonder what, like, not, and we won't know this for 10, 15, 20 years, societally this is going to have, what effect it'll have long term.
Yeah, and I think like one of the interesting things someone I spoke to was saying that there's indications that people are kind of rushing through the dating process, you know, and you know, it's more becoming almost more transaction in terms of like, how much do you earn? How much do I earn? Okay, we could get our own place together. And Dr. Caroline West, I spoke to, she was saying like she's seen indications of people kind of ignoring red flags in early stages of relationships because they're thinking, well, this is my ticket out of my parents' box room. I can deal with that. And maybe kind of staying in relationship or people who are renting together and they know if I, you know, this isn't a healthy relationship, but if we break up, I have to go back home or maybe I don't have anywhere to go. So I have to stick it out. And that's all really toxic and damaging. But I think there's also that kind of wider demographic issue of if you have people struggling to form relationships, moving into their own place later in life, that probably delays them starting families of their own. It maybe means they have smaller families. It maybe means they encounter fertility issues that they wouldn't have done if they were able to do it earlier. And that has a massive impact on the entire country then in terms of demographics and everything down the line too. Again, we won't really see the fruits of that probably for decades, but it is, there is the potential there. You can kind of see this combination of problems that really could become a big issue for everybody in the future.
Finally then, to take the other side of that, looking ahead to the future, often political leaders, business leaders, leaders in general, they're shaped by what they grew up with, be that, say, the Troubles or the energy crisis and terrible economies through the 70s and 80s. When the bailout babies that are now coming into that leadership role, and I suppose we technically have one as tarnished, do we? Simon Harris is still just under 40. He's over 35, so that
rules. Okay, yeah.
But, you know, about in around that time. What do you think that is going to mean for the direction of the country, for these people who have that psyche of sort of the scarcity and the, you can't have a good thing because it'll be taken away?
Yeah, that is an interesting one. And again, it's real crystal ball stuff. But like at the moment, this generation that I'm talking about, they represent about a quarter of the adult population. So a sizable minority and obviously getting bigger. And you will assume that Gen Alpha or whatever they're called, the people who are coming behind them will probably face the same challenges, or at least over the next few years. So growing, I think the one projection I saw that millennials and Gen Z will make up three quarters of the workforce by 2030, which is, you know, just around the corner, really. So a really sizable kind of economic force and potentially political force as well. And yeah, like there is that question of, what, you know, what do they do? Do they become motivated? Do they become a bit more coordinated in terms of, you know, having an impact politically? You also wonder as well, you know, if there is that resentment towards older generations and the fact that they got to enjoy this stuff and then the younger people had to pick up the bill on that, how does that impact them when they're the people paying for the pensions and
slash the pension,
making decisions on housing for older people and nursing homes and all that kind of stuff? There is a risk that, you know, because I think the key to all this is that the social contract is broken now, that idea that get a good education, get a good job and the rest will follow. That doesn't happen now. You can get a good education, you get a good job. It doesn't mean that you're going to get a home or you're going to, you know, be able to start your life in that way. So if people feel like, well, the social contract didn't work for me, so tough everybody else, you know, do we become more kind of libertarian and resentful and kind of saying, you know, well, no one looks after me, so I'm not going to look after them. I think, or do people just kind of give up and leave the country, basically? You know, we have this kind of quiet brain drain going on, I think. I tried to be optimistic about it in the book. I know that doesn't sound like, but I did try to say maybe that like the fact that these people are so creative and engaged and clued in, as they become a bigger force, they'll figure out what to do and they'll just take the reins and say, right, you haven't solved the problem, we're going to do it for you, which I kind of hope. But as I say, if they don't, it's everybody's problem, including me as someone who isn't a bailout baby, and people older than me who might feel like, well, I'm all right, I've got my own place. Yeah. It's going to affect you down the line as well.
Well, on that cheerful note, Adam McGuire, thanks so much for coming in. Happy Christmas to you and the family as well. Really appreciate you coming in and chatting to us. And Adam's book, The Bailout Babies, published by Guild Books. And make sure you can use some of those Christmas book tokens to pick yourself up a copy. Hopefully the first of a few books. Not just blowing smoke, it's incredibly well written.
Oh, thank you very much. I really do appreciate that. Yeah, no, it was an enjoyable and very different kind of process to the day job. But yeah, it was an enjoyable thing to do. A nice challenge, you know.
And that day job is, of course, in the RT business desk, where you can catch Adam and his work there. So listen, that's all for the podcast from now. If you're looking for some audio entertainment over the festive season, if you're doing a bit of driving or whatever, remember there's more than 130 editions now of News Talk Daily on the Go Loud player to keep you entertained or wherever it is you stream your content. Have a great Christmas. But for now, for me, Sean Defoe, goodbye.